so pleased to introduce Rabbi Carrie Baker. And a number of us already know him because about a month ago he conducted a session, a series of sessions in Tuesday Night Lights. It was called Judaism 101. So we learned some things. I found it very stimulating. Judaism 101. Today's subject, a bit different. Carrie, away we go.
Thank you, Mr. Green. I'm glad, Leon, you didn't say that we were going to have an interesting time or a good time, that everybody's going to learn a lot today, because I'm not sure that's going to happen. We're talking about the Middle East. And this is one of those things in life we've all come across them from time to time, where everybody knows what's true and nobody knows anything. Okay? So I'm going to start with this premise. Now, I will also say that not knowing anything is a relative term. There's some of us know more nothing than others. And while I am not an expert in Middle Eastern history, I've been reading and studying about it for more than 30 years. So I know something. Well, maybe not something, but less nothing than some. But I want to start off, and I don't mean to be offensive, but I'm going to guess that for most people in the room, what you know about the Middle East and about the conflict between Israel and its neighbors is what you read in the newspapers or see on TV, or what you hear from your friends, things of that sort. When I was a kid, which is going back to the same time that many of you were kids, one of the things that was new in the world was something called sex education. And it was new because up until that time, by and large, parents didn't tell their children about sex or teach them about sex. They were expected to learn about it from their friends. And that was not a very good system. In fact, we decided as a culture, well, some of us decided, some of us haven't made up our minds yet, that it would be a better idea to actually teach about it. That some myths and misinformation and so forth could be corrected as a result of actually learning about sex in an organized and intentional and rational sort of way.
Be careful.
It is the case that that has been helpful. We know more, behavior has changed, and so on and so forth. Well, I'm going to tell you that the same thing is true about the Middle East. What most people know about the Middle East, if it was just that they knew nothing, we'd be better off. But they think they know something. And because they think they know something, and what they think they know is something that riles them up, they're very passionate about what they don't know. Now, I was trying to find on YouTube, I just got this brainstorm as we were starting, the song that Yul Brynner sings from The King and I. Is a puzzlement, you know that song? Okay. And one of the lines of that song is essentially something to the effect that people will fight for what they think that they do not know. Okay? Now, that is the starting point for most discussions about Israel and the Middle East. And I've been doing this now for 30 years, and I have to tell you that I'm tired. I'm tired of nobody knowing anything. Because the fact that people don't know anything, and it hasn't changed in 30 years, makes it very difficult to actually live in the world. So I'm coming from that point of view. And I will do my best to be teacherly. But, you know, if you're talking to a Jewish person, or you're talking to a Muslim, you have a dog in the fight. Anybody who tells you that they don't care one way or the other is lying to you. So I'm going to declare my bias up front. I am against the destruction of the state of Israel. Okay? Maybe you are too.
You're against what?
The destruction of the state of Israel. Okay? Not everybody in the world would agree with that statement, which is kind of why we're here talking about it. Okay. So let's start. Would anybody, based on what you know, tell me what the most important date is, most important year, in the history of the relations between Israel and its Arab nation? Yeah.
1948.
Why would you say that's the most important year?
1948 is important because it's the year that Israel returned as a state.
That's true. Absolutely right. Ding, 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 ding. You get a point. Okay? That's true, but it is not the most important date, in my opinion, in terms of the conflict between Israel and its neighbors. Because you have to sort of start with the given that, you know, the conflict exists because Israel exists. If there were no Israel, there would be no conflict, right? So in the context of there being a conflict, what's the important date? The important date is 1974. Because in 1964. Because in 1964, the Palestine Liberation Organization was founded. Now, why do I say that that is the most important date? Because in a way, lots of information, lots of differing opinions, et cetera, et cetera. But in one important sense, all you really have to know about the nature of the conflict is that in 1964, before the 67 Six-Day War, in which Israel was attacked and conquered the West Bank and Gaza Strip and the Golan Heights near Syria, the Palestine Liberation Organization was founded. Now you have to ask yourself a question. Why would the Palestine Liberation Organization be founded in 1964 when Israel was not occupying any of these territories? What had to be liberated? It's an interesting question.
All the territory that they had been displaced, Palestinians had been displaced.
Well, we'll get to the question about displacement in a minute. So what territory are you talking about?
Gaza.
No. Israel didn't control Gaza until 1967. The State of Israel itself, 1947 boundaries. When the Palestine Liberation Organization was founded, it was founded in order to liberate Palestine, which then only referred to the part that was the State of Israel. It didn't refer to the West Bank, didn't refer to the Golan Heights, didn't refer to the Gaza Strip. That is a historical fact, which is undeniable. So you have to ask yourself the question, why was that the reason to found the PLO? And the answer is that, as is stated in the Charter, and still states in the Charter of Hamas, the point of this whole exercise is whether or not Israel should exist. That's what we're talking about. That is the bottom line. And we all do all sorts of things to hope that that's really not the case. We would like to think that's not the case. We would like to think that the goal of those who are in opposition to the State of Israel is justice for the Palestinians. But you have to ask yourself the question. In 1964, let's say, when the West Bank was controlled by Jordan and Egypt controlled the Gaza Strip and Syria controlled the Golan Heights, why was there no state of Palestine? Because it was not important. It was not the goal. You know, I hate to be categorical in this way, but there are some things that are facts that are true that you have to sort of know about. And you have to think about it. If you want to argue that Israel is simply an occupier, then you have to ask yourself the question, why was Palestine needing to be liberated before Israel occupied anything? Okay? All right, now why do I bring this up? Because you have to sort of step through the looking glass. a little bit of history. In the early days of the existence of the State of Israel, the way that the world saw the problem of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians was, here was little Israel, a nation of that time, you know, maybe 3.5 million people, now it's about 6, surrounded by 22 Arab nations who were hostile to it. But that's not how anybody would describe it today, is it? Today, we would describe it as, here's this gigantic Goliath, Israel. With the little Palestinian people and the refugee camps. How did that become the case? How did our view change? That's a very interesting point. 1974, number two date in the importance of the Israel-Palestinian or Israel-Arab conflict. In 1974, there was a conference in the city of Rabat. And this conference was essentially a strategizing conference of the Arab nations, how to handle the problem of the existence of the State of Israel. Because you remember, in 1973, anybody know what happened in 1973?
Another war.
Yeah, what war?
Yom Kippur.
The Yom Kippur War. Would anybody know what happened?
The Arab nations.
Sorry?
The Arab nations attacked Israel.
Yes, when?
On Yom Kippur.
It was, you know, like Pearl Harbor. It was a sneak attack. Okay. And Israel almost lost that war. Almost. I don't know. It was in danger. Now, in the end, Israel won, and the state continued to exist, but at a tremendous cost, of course, for everybody. You know, war is war. Nobody's exempt. But this was the number one best organized, best supported, best planned, best weaponized effort on the part of the Arab nations to defeat the State of Israel. And it was unsuccessful. And it caused the Arab nations to reevaluate their strategy, which up until that time was what? We're big, we're strong, they're little, they're tiny, we're going to get rid of them. Like in 67 when Nasser said what? Sirius said what? Anybody know? We're going to drive them into the sea. Okay? But they had failed. Now, they even had the surprise element in their favor, and they still couldn't beat Israel. So it was time to reevaluate the strategy. So in Rabat, they had a conference which was aimed at reevaluating this policy of having armies attack Israel's army. Now, don't misunderstand. There had always been terrorism going on in this area, going all the way back to the 1920s. You know, some of the sad things about history. You can find nasty stuff wherever you look if you want to. You know, how should I put it? There is a myth that we have that back in the old days, the relations were idyllic and everybody kind of got along. And then Israel came along and everything changed. That's not true. I'm sorry. There, sometimes relations were good. In particular places, it was sometimes good. But as a general rule, you know, it was not always so wonderful. You would have to explain this to the 27,000 Jews who were driven out of Hebron in 1948. Okay? But this is one fact. I'm not saying that, therefore, the Arabs are wrong and the Jews are right. I'm just saying that the idea that somehow one side is characterized as victims and the other side is characterized as victimizers is a simple, if not simplistic, view. Okay? So, in 1974 in Rabat, during this period of this meeting which was aimed at reevaluating strategy, there were conclusions, the three no's. no negotiation was number one. We don't have, now, I'm going to tell you right away that this is from Dennis Prager, who's a conservative commentator, with whom I, that's not it, I rarely agree. But in this case, I kind of do. So, if I can find it. Okay.
I took many courses on the question of the Middle East conflict. Semester after semester, we studied the Middle East conflict as if it was the most complex conflict in the world, when in fact, it is probably the easiest conflict in the world to explain. It may be the hardest to solve, but it is the easiest to explain. In a nutshell, it's this. One side wants the other side dead. Israel wants to exist as a Jewish state and to live in peace. Israel also recognizes the right of Palestinians to have their own state and to live in peace. The problem, however, is that most Palestinians and many other Muslims and Arabs do not recognize the right of the Jewish state of Israel to exist. This has been true since 1947, when the United Nations voted to divide the land called Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state. The Jews accepted the United Nations partition, but no Arab or any other Muslim country accepted it. When British rule ended on May 15, 1948, the armies of all the neighboring Arab states, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Transjordan, and Egypt, attacked the one-day-old state of Israel in order to destroy it. But to the world's surprise, the little Jewish state survived. Then it happened again. In 1967, the dictator of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser, announced his plan, in his words, to destroy Israel. He placed Egyptian troops on Israel's border, and armies of surrounding Arab countries were also mobilized to attack. However, Israel preemptively attacked Egypt and Syria. Israel did not attack Jordan and begged Jordan's king not to join the war. But he did. And only because of that did Israel take control of Jordanian land, specifically the West Bank of the Jordan River. Shortly after the war, the Arab states went to Khartoum, Sudan, and announced their famous three no's: no recognition, no peace, and no negotiations. What was Israel supposed to do? Well, one thing Israel did a little more than a decade later in 1978 was to give the entire Sinai Peninsula, an area of land bigger than Israel itself and with oil, back to Egypt, because Egypt, under new leadership, signed a peace agreement with Israel. So Israel gave land for the promise of peace with Egypt, and it has always been willing to do the same thing with the Palestinians. All the Palestinians have ever had to do is recognize Israel as a Jewish state and promised to live in peace with it. But when Israel has proposed trading land for peace, as it did in 2000, when it agreed to give the Palestinians a sovereign state in more than 95% of the West Bank and all of Gaza, the Palestinian leadership rejected the offer and instead responded by sending waves of suicide terrorists into Israel. Meanwhile, Palestinian radio, television, and school curricula remain filled with glorification of terrorists, demonization of Jews, and the daily repeated message that Israel should cease to exist. So it's not hard to explain the Middle East dispute. One side wants the other dead. The motto of Hamas, the Palestinian rulers of Gaza, is, "We love death as much as the Jews love life." There are 22 Arab states in the world, stretching from the Atlantic Ocean to the Indian Ocean. There is one Jewish state in the world, and it is about the size of New Jersey. In fact, tiny El Salvador is larger than Israel. Finally, think about these two questions. If tomorrow Israel laid down its arms and announced, we will fight no more. All but happened. And if the Arab countries around Israel laid down their arms and announced, we will fight no more, what would happen? In the first case, there would be an immediate destruction of the state of Israel and mass murder of its Jewish population. In the second case, there would be peace the next day. As I said at the outset, it is a simple problem to describe. One side wants the other dead. And if it didn't, there would be peace. Please remember this. There has never been a state in the geographic area known as Palestine that was not Jewish. Israel is the third Jewish state to exist in that area. There was never an Arab state, never a Palestinian state, never a Muslim or any other state. That's the issue. Why can't the one Jewish state the size of El Salvador be allowed to exist? That is the Middle East problem. I'm Dennis Prager.
I noticed that there are some of you who are upset because you think you know something. That may not be entirely true.
You guys were talking to me too, and that's
what?
Part of it. You talk about oversimplifications, and that it seems very oversimplified itself.
Yeah.
Every state that has nuclear weapons in the Middle East.
Well.
There's some that may have them soon, but right now.
How is that relevant to the struggle of the Palestinians?
But this idea that it's so weak.
Well, it's not as weak now as it once was.
But that it's so peaceful. That flies.
It's really hard because right now.
First of all, how long was that?
Even that guy with the Likud party on the news.
Yeah.
7 minutes.
It sounds very much like the three no's. No recognition of the Palestinian state.
That's what he said.
No negotiations with them because they're terrorists.
That's not what he said. That's not what he said.
Like
if you want to debate me, which I didn't want to do.
It's
fine.
My emotional.
Yeah, I know. I saw you just cooking back there. And yeah, I understand.
I don't know enough to debate you.
No. But here's the thing. Everybody in dealing with the Middle East is in the position of, how do I put it? Public statements by politicians, whether they're Israeli politicians or Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority or President Obama or whoever you want to talk about, has a particular audience in mind when they make public statements. And it is not always the case that when they make public statements, their idea is to speak the truth. They want to have political effect. You have to figure out who are they speaking to and for what reason. Okay, so that's point number one. If you don't do that, and you don't sort of read the statements with that little bit of jaundiced eye, then you're going to make a lot of mistakes. So, in the case of both Abbas and Netanyahu, they always have to talk in part to their internal audience. It may or may not always reveal what they really think in terms of policy. It may not always reveal what they really are doing in terms of policy. For example, while Netanyahu is making that statement, you know that there are negotiations going on, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
He also boasted about not living up to the Oslo Accords. Sometimes it's hard to know what's really going on because it's some of the things that are coming.
You are a wise man. You just said the magic words. What did you just say?
Disinformation.
Well, all right, relax.
It sounds like boasting of torpedoing, though.
Well, look, I always look at actions, okay? People make lots of statements for lots of different reasons. I look at actions. Israel has peace treaties with Egypt, with Jordan. In both cases, Israel sat down with those people, came to an agreement, peace. End of story. But with the Palestinians, not so easy. You have to ask yourself the question, okay, how is it that Israel is like so ridiculously obtuse in this area and not so obtuse over there? And the answer is that there are two parties involved here. And that not necessarily is everybody's goal the same. Okay? And that's part of the difference. Look, I'll put it to you this way. Let's take the example of, well, leave aside Hamas for a second, because they are clearly not interested in the existence of the state of Israel. They've said so, and they behave in such a way that you believe that what they say. You know, they fire rockets and so on and so forth. And
aren't they in control of Gaza?
Yeah, they are in control of Gaza. But now, and here's the difficulty, they are the partner of the Palestine Authority in the government of Palestine as a whole. And since that happened, negotiations have gotten very, very complicated. Why is that more complicated? Because Hamas has not moderated his point of view regarding the existence of the state of Israel, whereas the Palestinian Authority has. If the negotiations were just with the Palestinian Authority, they'd be over. But they're not. Hamas is involved. And that makes things much more complicated. Yes, ma'am.
So one of the things that's reported is that, for instance, there, in the latest strikes from Israel, is that there were schools and places set up by the UN that were supposed to be safe houses for
right.
just families. And those schools were bombed.
Some of them were.
So was that a mistake, or was that...
In some cases, it's a mistake, but in some cases, it's part of the dilemma. Look, when Hamas says that they love death as much as the Jews love life, they really have something very particular in mind. And they're not just being obtuse, well, they are evil, but... I shouldn't say that. But they have something particular in mind. They're talking about the importance and the holiness of martyrdom. Okay? Dying as a martyr is a good thing in their point of view. More important than living. Okay? That, you know, you and I may have our opinions about this notion of martyrdom, because it's not at all like the martyrdom concept we have in the West. But it comes out of a certain particular point of view about the Quran. Not everybody who is a Muslim agrees with this, but the Hamas people do in the so-called Wahhabists and so forth, the very conservative element, do. So for them, they really do mean it when they say that death, a certain kind of death, is more important to them than life, okay? So, what Hamas does in terms of their strategy changes because of this belief. The way it changes is that since dying for resistance is a good thing, it's a holy kind of death, and everybody, in their view, should be ready to be a martyr, then it's okay for them to put those people, from our point of view, in danger. Because all that's going to happen to them is that those people will die a martyr's death, and they'll go immediately to paradise. So putting stores of ammunition and weapons and so forth in schools, in mosques, et cetera, having rocket launching sites in the middle of a courtyard for an apartment building, so forth, all things which are documented in that particular war, from their point of view, oddly enough, is a good thing. It's not just a strategy. It's not just because, I mean, it is a strategy, but it's not just a strategy. It's not just to try to get the Israelis not to bomb. That's really not what they're interested in. They want the Israelis to bomb, which is exactly what they have to do because they're shooting rockets, for crying out loud. But to them, they're not endangering anybody. From their point of view, they're allowing them to die a martyr's death, which is a good thing. Now, in the West, we would say, well, that should be a decision of the people who are in danger. If they want to die a martyr's death, that's up to them. We might not like it. We may not approve of it morally or whatever it may be. But it ought to be the decision of the person involved. But, as you will have noticed, in Muslim countries around the world, This was not always true, by the way, only in recent years. The idea of an Islamic government which takes a certain point of view about the Quran and imposes it on a population, whether they want it or not, has become a very common occurrence in the world.
But then...
Yeah.
So, number one,
yeah.
You're killing the people who don't necessarily agree with the people you're fighting against.
Yes.
And number two, you're creating martyrs, which doesn't that actually feed into...
It's a total dilemma. It's a total dilemma. Here's the thing. What is the first responsibility of a state? It's to protect its citizens. If it doesn't do that, it has no purpose of any significance. So, you know, the Israelis have to stop the rockets from being fired. Now, you can say, well, not that many people died. Well, please, if that's the point of view, then who is the cynic and who is not? If you want to debate the policy as a matter of relative body counts, okay? Well, there's only, you know, relatively speaking, a few Jews are dying. So, you know, they ought to just back off and not try to stop the rockets and do whatever they have to do to stop the rockets, because it's not that many people dying. You know, what are you so excited about? You know, sometimes people need to hear what somebody else say what they're actually advocating. Okay? Is it the case that there's anybody here who says it doesn't matter if there aren't enough Israelis dying? Is that really the position anybody wants to argue?
In our class, you showed us a long list of all the
problems
that have, and all the
right.
All the many, many wars that have killed off of many, many Jews over the years.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just can't, they just don't want a culture to die out.
Yeah. Well, look, the Palestinians don't want their culture to die out either. It's a reasonable thing. So why do you elect Hamas to be your government? It's not a secret what Hamas wants to do, what they plan to do. And here's the background. And I'm going to say this even though I know it's dangerous to say it. Sometimes people try to learn lessons of history. And one of the lessons that the Jews have learned over the years is that when it comes to Jewish existence, you have to take threats seriously. Hitler, for example, in Mein Kampf, said exactly what he was going to do. It was no secret what he planned. But everybody said, oh, you know, he'll come into the government, and he'll have a stake in things, he'll moderate, and so on and so forth. Or some people said, yeah, he's a crazy kind of guy, we'll control him. Well, I don't have to tell you what happened. So, we take these things seriously. When someone says it's his intention, should I say, or her intention? Oh, no. To end you, I got you. Should we take it seriously or not? I had a friend who was a professor of philosophy who used to talk about what he called the reasonable man argument. Anybody here know what the reasonable man argument is? Somebody's nodding. You know it. What is it? What's the reasonable man?
I know some of it. It's just that this is what a reasonable man would think or react, etc.
What you knowing what you know at a certain point in time, what would a reasonable man do? Okay? In other words, instead of ruling your position or forming your position because of some kind of ideological position that you have, or even some sort of moral imperative that you feel, what the reasonable man does is do what is basically best under the circumstances.
Situation ethics.
Well, in a way, it's a little bit more complicated than situation ethics, but yeah, sort of like that. And basically, we'd say, look, would a reasonable man do X under these circumstances, whatever the X happens to be? And this is Philip Thomas, the guy's name, is the professor. He said, look, if you know what you know about Jewish history, and you know what you know about the history of relations between Jews and the rest of the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And somebody said to you, don't worry, we got your back. Okay? Don't worry, we'll take care of you. We'll make sure that nothing will happen. Would a reasonable man say, no problem, we'll leave it to you. Your guarantees, your assurances are fine by me.
See, I think that you've really stated the crux of the problem when you say the reasonable man.
Oh, please. Are we going to do that? Yeah? Yeah, you know that there's a huge number of women who are suicide murderers, suicide bombers as well.
Well, I would like to hear you speak some also on the occupation,
the settlement,
West Bank.
Excellent question.
And the continued reason why the Israeli government continues to build Israeli homes and that kind of thing in territory
That's a very good question, and it's a very complicated question, as you might expect. All right, look.
And part of that,
yes, sir.
There is a book called The Lemon Tree, which I strongly recommend to everybody, and it, in a very warm, human way, shows that, or expresses the view that the root of the problem is that the people who lived there in 46, 7, were uprooted, often with no notice, and hauled off as refugees in order to make space for an Israeli. And nobody has ever really dealt, I think that's part of what you're saying, with the feelings of these people who have been displaced. And they're still refugees.
Yes. This is a very complicated question, too. And you have to, the question of how they became refugees and why they're still refugees are two very different questions. There are a number of reasons why refugees in that part of the world became refugees. One is that in some cases they were exiled from the land by Israelis. It's also true that they were encouraged to leave by the Arab governments to get them out of the way of the surely to be victorious attack on the state of Israel and then a subsequent return to their homes. That is also true.
Is it also true that they were promised compensation that they've never received?
No, they were never promised compensation. UN passed that as a resolution. The Israeli government never promised anybody compensation. It's a really interesting question. So then you have to ask yourself the question, okay, while these refugees were being created for a variety of reasons, sometimes in order to get people out of a military area where there was a battle about to take place, sometimes they were expelled, sometimes they left on their own with the idea that they're going to go back. Were there any other refugees anywhere? There were. There were actually about an equal number of Jewish refugees from Arab countries at the same time. Does anybody know what happened to them?
They were killed.
No, they weren't.
What about the Holocaust? Holocaust
is a different story. I'm talking about refugees
from the Arab states.
What happened to those refugees? About 500,000.
Well, some of those people are still living in those countries.
Well, not that they're not refugees then if they're still there. Yeah, but sorry?
Some of them migrated to Israel.
Yeah, about 500,000 to 600,000 went to Israel. And what happened to them in Israel? Were they put into refugee camps? Well, they were in what we call absorption centers. And eventually, after a period of acclimatization and so forth, they became Israeli citizens and went on with their lives. Almost an equal number to the number of Palestinians who, for a variety of different reasons, some positive, some negative, some mixed, were left or were expelled, whatever you want to say, from Israel, and who were put in refugee camps, and who were kept there by intention, by policy, by Arab governments.
Could they not go to other
They couldn't go anywhere.
They were kept.
No, they were just, yes, That was exactly the case.
How many Palestinians are in Israel now?
Well, it depends what you mean by Palestinian. Did I offend you?
No. It's choir.
I just wanted to understand. Right now, out of the total population, about 6.5 million Israelis, about 1.25 million, are Palestinians. I guess you call them Palestinians, but not all Palestinians. Some are Muslims or Arabs from other parts of the world. And by the way, an interesting point here. Not to deny the fact that there isn't tension in Israel between the Jews and the Muslims who are there, and that there isn't difficulties that have to be worked out. Like, for example, in the United States, there is with regard to minority populations and so on and so forth. But having said all that and having stipulated all that, in Israel, Palestinians can vote, they are citizens, they have jobs, and they have more freedom than any citizen of any other country in the region. I want you to understand this. The Palestinians who live in Israel, not talking about the West Bank, okay? The Palestinians who live in Israel have more freedom than citizens of other Arab countries all around.
Rabbi, could you comment on the issue of Jerusalem and dividing it?
Sure, but I didn't get to the question you have to sort of look at the question of what happens in the West Bank from the standpoint of there being kind of different levels of response. There's what we would all like to do. There's what we'd all wish were the case. And then there's what you have to do because of the exigencies of the situation. Okay? Now, here's an example. It's a beautiful example. Many, many people are concerned about two things. There's a fence, right? And we don't like fences. As Americans, we are against fences, okay? Think about the romance of the West. Don't fence me in, okay? We don't like fences. We like freedom. You go wherever you want. You do whatever you want. That's the way it is. Of course, most of the world is not like that. Most of the world, you have identity cards, and you have to pass through checkpoints and so forth all the time. Why did Israel build this fence? Why did it establish checkpoints in the West Bank? Was it to make the lives of the Palestinians miserable? Well, it does make the lives of the Palestinians more miserable than it would be otherwise, but was that the point? No, it was not the point. Why? What was the point? Well, until the fence was built, until the checkpoint system was established, there was, you may remember, a series of things called the Intifada. And what happened during the Intifada, both Intifada I and Intifada II, was that for a number of different things. One thing that happened was people would strap explosives to their bodies, walk freely across the border because there was no fence and no checkpoints. And they would go to a discotheque or a grocery store or a bus, whatever it was, and blow it up, themselves included. This happened time and time again. I'm not talking about a couple of isolated incidents. I'm talking about almost a daily occurrence at some points. Okay? There are scores and scores of people on almost a daily basis who are blown up in public places in Israel. Right? This is a fact. Now, you can say, well, maybe they had good reason to do it. I'm not so sure, but you could say that, maybe. But it doesn't matter what their reason was. If you're an Israeli, you want it to stop. It doesn't matter if they're somehow justified, if this is somehow holy resistance, this is somehow jihad, so what? If you're an Israeli, you have to stop it. So what do you do?
Put up a fence.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You put up a fence, and you control access to Israel from the West Bank. Now, see, if I look at it from this point of view, I say, if I was really interested in not accepting any risk at all for any of this, I wouldn't permit people to come in at all. Because, you know, even the best security system is sometimes wrong. So why didn't Israel just say, okay, no Palestinians altogether, can come into our country. End of story. For a variety of reasons. Economically, it was good for the Palestinians and good for the Israelis. It benefited both sides economically. Right now, the average yearly earnings of an Israeli is about $30,000 a year. The average earnings of a Palestinian, about $2,000. Okay?
Palestinian in Palestine, not in Israel.
Oh, not in Israel. No, in the so-called occupied territories. Yeah, right. So what little economic activity is going on there, much of it has to do with people working in Israel and bringing salaries back to the West Bank. So what would happen if Israel just cut it off? It would be bad for them, for sure, but it would also be bad for the Israelis because these people do reasonable work and they contribute to the economy. So what do? Well, you establish checkpoints and lines and everybody gets examined, everybody gets talked to, everybody has an evaluation, and then you allow them to go through certain places where you can sort of keep a tab on them. That's how you do it. Now, here's the fact. During the building of the fence, before it was complete, the number of terrorist events in areas where there was a fence decreased by 80%. That's a fact. Now, why in the world, if you're an Israeli, would you be against the fence? Well, you might be against the fence because in the ideal world, it's a terrible thing to have fences. In the ideal world, you don't want people to be segregated from each other. You want people to interact. But in the real world, sometimes you have to compromise those kinds of principles. And if you're the parent of an Israeli kid who has to take a bus to go to school, public bus, you're not so interested in whether or not a Palestinian has to wait 2 hours in line to get through the checkpoints. Okay, you understand?
About the continued building of the
settlements. Okay. I have very little sympathy for the settlements. I think they're provocation. There is some disagreement, but by and large, most people agree that they are illegal under international law. But here's where there is a little bit of an argument on the other side that you need to know. Does anybody here know the term Judenrein? See what I mean?
Sounds German.
It is German.
Nazi.
It is Nazi. Yes. It means a place where there is no Jews. Okay, Judenrein. Jews are gone. Okay? Hitler said that the whole point of his activity was to create a place which was Judenrein, empty of Jews. Okay? And it is kind of weird when you think that in Hebrew the expression davka, it's like we mean something like ironically. That ironically, on the West Bank, which unquestionably, because of through archaeological evidence, et cetera, is part of the patrimony of the Jewish people, part of our history, okay? That would be the one place in the world where Jews are not allowed to live. We would say, if it was some other group, well, how can you do that? How can you say that people are not allowed to live in a certain locale? We would say that is discriminatory. We would say that is against the most sacred principles that we have about human dignity and human rights. But when it comes to the West Bank, we don't say that. We say, absolutely, provocation. They should be gone. Now, I guess I preface this by saying I'm not in favor of the settlements. Okay? So as far as I'm concerned, they could go away tomorrow, and because in the real world, you have to say, okay, the ideology that Jews should be able to live wherever they want to live, they should have this freedom, and so on and so forth. All right, maybe not so much right now, maybe not so much this area, we can live with that. But it's not entirely wrong. Here's the interesting part. In relation to Gaza, when Sharon Ariel Sharon, who was then the Prime Minister of Israel, very right-wing kind of guy. But it was sort of like Nixon to China. Nixon could go to China, and liberals couldn't do that because, you know, you couldn't trust liberals to do the right thing. Nixon could get away with it. Well, Sharon could do what I'm about to tell you, and it would be okay because he was so far to the right. He decided that, you know, trying to protect these settlements in Gaza was ridiculous. It required a huge amount of soldiers and money and so on and so forth. And to what point? So he said, okay, you know what? We're done. And he pulled out all the settlers from Gaza. And believe me, this was not an easy process. They didn't say, oh, okay, we'll go. They fought the Israeli soldiers who were taking them out tooth and nail to prevent them being removed from that area. You know, after all, they had spent money and time and effort and so forth to create a place where they were going to live, and they had an ideological reason, so on and so forth. All that was true. Didn't stop Sharon and the Israeli government from pulling them out against their will, because it made sense politically and strategically and so on and so forth. So what I have to say to you with regard to settlements is, I look, as a Palestinian, I couldn't say this, but I'm not, so I can. Don't get so excited about settlements. Places can be settled, and they can be unsettled. And maybe it's true that all the settlements aren't going to go away, but undoubtedly some of them are. And in the course of negotiation, I guarantee you, if there's a peace treaty on the table that people believe in, and it hinges on this or that settlement being dismantled, I guarantee you in 2 seconds the Israelis will decide to dismantle it, and that's the end of that settlement. Oh. Dale's been waiting very patiently. Will you repeat the question?
One of the sticking points, apparently, is the subdivision of Jerusalem.
Yes.
Okay. A Palestinian state with its capital in one part of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Okay. I personally think that's a red herring, but that's just me, and I'm pretty uninformed about this. So you studied it.
Well, there are a lot of possibilities besides sort of the zero-sum game that's involved. Yeah, there are more positions than simply saying either the entire thing is controlled by Israel or the entire thing is controlled by the state of Palestine or whatever it's going to be called when it comes into existence. All of them are compromises of one sort or another, but workable compromises. The one thing that's not possible is this idea that some people float of an international city, because this is a question of sovereignty for both sides. However, the idea of there being a kind of shared sovereignty along certain kinds of lines is very realistic. It's already what happens with regard to certain holy sites in Israel itself, where there's an organization that with representation of various interest groups who are in charge of the administration of a certain area, whether it's the Temple Mount or the Church of the Holy Sepulchre or whatever it may be. The idea that probably is most popular right now, although I mean still minority opinion, is that some such arrangement for Jerusalem is possible, whereas you have a kind of, you might even say, shared sovereignty or shared administration of the city. Now, there are certain extremists on both sides who will never accept anything but, you know, the zero-sum equation, but there are many people, and I think it's growing, who would disagree with that and would accept this kind of arrangement. Because you can have sovereignty and yet be in a cooperative relationship with other people who also have sovereignty. You know, so, it's not easy to do, but there are already cases where it's being done. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so I'm going back to it's a dilemma.
Yeah.
Just as you said, Jewish parents whose children are on the bus don't care if Palestinians have to wait 2 hours. I'll give that to you. That's perfectly valid to me. But it's the same for the people who are in these schools that get bombed. Hamas says it's okay if they're martyrs. Israel says it's unfortunate, but we gotta kill them. I don't care.
Well,
they're my kids, and I want them to be safe. So
yes, absolutely.
So how do you make these people who are nothing but caught in crossfire safe?
It's heart-wrenching. Absolutely, there's no question about it. First thing you have to do is to recognize, how do I put it, whose problem it is. Now, this is not nice, but I'll be clear. It is not Israel's problem. It is Hamas's problem. They are the government there.
See, I say it's the innocent children who are dying's problem.
Well, no. I mean, that they're in that position is not their problem. They don't have a vote, okay? Now, if you're Israel, what do you do? Well, you leaflet an area or you use telephones to say to people, look, we're going to bomb this area. Please leave. Which Israel regularly did.
Ebola.
No, not Ebola. And then you could, you ask the question, so what was the response of the citizens of Gaza to these warnings? Well, the citizens of Gaza were quite willing, more often than not, to leave the area so they wouldn't get hurt. So why didn't they leave the area? Because, from the view of Hamas, being a martyr was so important, it didn't matter what the people there actually wanted to do. Doggone it, you're going to stay where you are. And if that means you're going to be a martyr, then that's just what you have to do. And now, look, do I think that some of the people who made that, voiced that kind of opinion were cynical? Yeah, I do. But I'm trying to make the best case argument. There were some also who believed that this was their actual belief. So, in the case of the kids, it's a terrible thing, yes, absolutely. But you have to answer the question, so what should the Israelis do? They allow the rockets to come across the border? I don't know. Next time, don't vote for Hamas. Yes, sir.
Do you think there's going to be a conflict between Israel and Iran?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No. I think that the sanctions and so forth are working. I think there are no negotiations going on. And here's a good example of what I'm talking about in terms of addressing comments to your internal audience. Netanyahu has to be tough, because that satisfies sort of the extremists in Israel. They're, he's being tough, they're standing up, But what's going on meanwhile? There are negotiations. And meanwhile, what is Israel doing? Nothing. You gotta look at what people do, not only what they say. So what's going on right now is the negotiations are working, they're moving forward. And Israelis are just like the good cop, bad cop, okay? The United States is the good cop, and Israel is the bad cop. Israel's threatens, and the Iranians are concerned about that. And meanwhile, the United States says, listen, you better negotiate with us, because if you don't negotiate with us, you know what's going to happen. That's right, they're going to bomb you. So, yeah.
I have another question. There's been a rise in, what's that? Jewish religious site that's they don't work, and what are they called? The group of people that
speak up, Jane.
The Haredim?
No.
The kibbutz. They're getting more political power. Are they going to be a problem?
The kibbutzim are.
Could you repeat his question?
I'm not sure I can repeat it yet, because I'm not sure I know what it is yet.
There's a group of religious people, I can't remember their name.
The ultra-Orthodox
are rising in their ability to vote, and they're very extreme, and I was just wondering if that's going to be a problem.
It already is a problem. You may have noticed that the rise of conservative religion is a global phenomenon. It's not happening just in Israel. It's even happening in our own country. Okay? All around the world, there is a rise in extreme conservative religion. It's not the only thing that's happening around the world, but it's one of the things that's happening around the world, and it's happening in Israel too. And Israel has the following problem. You may have already noticed that there's a lot of division of opinion in Israel. Israel, you know, people say, when you have two Jews, you have three opinions, okay? And if that's true of Jews in general, it's even more true of Israelis, okay? Israel has what's called a parliamentary government. And it's not just a parliamentary government, because England has a parliamentary government too, but the people who get elected to parliament in England come from a certain district. So they have to represent the interests of that district. In Israel, because of the beginning, they wanted the nation to be unified. They didn't do it that way. Each party has a list of candidates. And depending upon their percentage of votes in the election, they get to have 5, 10, 15, whatever the number is, of representatives in parliament, called the Knesset. Well, what this means is that there are always coalition governments in Israel. It is very, very rare for any party to have an absolute majority by itself. And as a result, you have to make compromises with a number of different parties if you're the plurality party. The National Religious Party used to be part of even the labor governments. But they had a little teeny interest. Their little teeny interest was, we just want to be in charge of how people observe the Sabbath and who gets to get married and so on and so forth. And you give us that, we're happy. But as conservative religion in Israel and elsewhere has gotten more and more strident and intense and so on and so forth, their interests have widened. They now are interested in foreign policy, for example. They weren't always interested in foreign policy. Since they are usually part of the coalition government, they get a say. Because if they pull out of the coalition, the government falls and you have to have new elections. Now, this is essentially puts them in the position of having a veto on government policy in lots of different areas, including foreign policy.
Rabbi, we're about out of time.
Oh, okay.
If you could spend a minute or two to summarize, wrap up.
Sure, yeah, no problem. all right, so you've already heard about one book. What was it called, The Yellow Tree?
The Lemon Tree.
Yeah, which is, I think you ought to consider reading. There's a lot of stuff that I can recommend as well. But here's the thing. I know everybody here is busy. Everybody here has lots of things going on. And it's sometimes hard to find time to read and so forth. If you would like, I would be glad to compile a list of websites from all over the spectrum, which you might want to consult, and I would be glad to email it to any of you who would like to.
Please.
Yeah, if I can get people's emails, I'll be glad to do that. You can read for yourself, you know, see what you think. All right, Eugene, so, all right. So if you tell me how to get in touch with you, I'll be glad to do that.
He's our scribe.
Okay. The reason I put it that way is, look, today all we did was touch on some areas of the history and the politics of the Middle East. And as I said at the beginning, I am somebody with a point of view. I warned you at the beginning about that. But there is, as often as there are people with whom you can't have a discussion, even if, because of their point of view is so all-encompassing that they can't hear or talk about anything else, there are plenty of people, and I'd like to think I'm included in that, who have a point of view but you can talk to and come up with information that's useful, regardless of what your own point of view is. If I've convinced you of anything today, I hope it is to question what you assume you know about the Middle East, about Israel, about the Palestinians and so forth. And to look at what you hear from friends and the news and so on and so forth with just a little grain of salt, recognizing that there probably is more to the situation than you may be aware of. It would be helpful, in general, if people could have that kind of point of view, I might say, about many things in life, but certainly with regard to the Middle East. So thank you all very much for coming.
We'd like to present you with a small token of our appreciation.
Thank you. Thank you. That's lovely. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.